I am Plante on the line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Andrew McLeod joins me again. The journalist has a new book out, Altogether Healthy, A Canadian Wellness Revolution. It's a cogent, thoughtful book on how a better society, a healthier society across the country could be had with a rethinking of social policy. Mr. McLeod, with his adept, approachable writing, illuminates the political and financial considerations, compares systems here and abroad, as well as looks critically at why we haven't thought about social conditions and their tremendous impact on health. If you haven't got stable employment, its detriment to health is often overlooked. Andrew McLeod is a legislative bureau chief in Victoria for the TIE.ca. He was last on this program when his first book, A Better Place on Earth, was published in 2015. That book went on to receive the George Riga Award for Social Awareness in Literature. This new book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Andrew's Twitter handle is @A_McLeod_TIE. Please welcome back to the Plante Online program in Victoria, Andrew McLeod. Mr. McLeod, good morning.
Yeah, hi, Joe. Thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks for joining us. So I've always wondered, you know, why it is that people know what's good for us, yet we don't. I mean, what's that line, an ounce of prevention is a pound of cure? I mean, we can quantify, can't we, the savings that preventative health has?
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, obviously, all of us in our individual lives, we would much rather stay healthy than get sick. And lots of us do take steps to avoid illness. You know, we exercise, we eat our vegetables, we sleep. But it's not as widespread as it might be. And when you look broader, when you start thinking, you know, as a broader society, you know, what are the things that contribute to health? You know, to what degree do we actually do those things? And that's the big question the book is asking. You know, do we do enough as a society to make sure that as many people are as healthy as possible? And if not, why not? And, you know, what would it take to get us to do those things?
A great place to start, I guess, is early childhood. And you talk in the book about early childhood development and that being a place where a lot more investment should take place. I mean, what's the figure that if you say invest a dollar today, the savings down the line, is it $7?
Yeah, that's a commonly quoted figure internationally, that every dollar you spend on early childhood, and that means, you know, early childhood education, but also supporting families, you save $7 later. And so that's $7 that you end up spending on health care or the correction system, jail, you know, all the things that we lay on when things go wrong in people's lives. And there's a ton of research about how important those early years are, you know, sort of from the time a child is zero or even in utero up until they are, you know, five or seven. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the conditions are already set at that point for, you know, how able they're going to be to participate in school and get the most out of it, you know, how they're going to behave and how ready they are going to be to learn. And that contributes to, you know, how they do when they get into the job market, and that contributes to everything down the road, including their health. So there's all kinds of research. So sometimes it's framed as people talk about adverse childhood experiences. So we all have some of those, right? That's things mm-hmm. like divorce in the family, witnessing violence, being a victim of violence, you know, having a parent in jail, you know, those sort of things. And so we all have some, but the more of them you have, the more likely you are to end up with all kinds of outcomes that would be best for the individual to avoid and best for society to avoid. And those are things like, you know, having a sexually transmitted disease, addictions, you know, mental health issues, suicide, sort of you name it, you know, across the board, the more adverse experiences you have as a child, the more likely you are to do poorly later. And we also know that the number of adverse experiences you have is likely connected to how much income your family has. Mm. So if your family is, you know, struggling to put food on the table, struggling to pay the rent, it's going to make it much more difficult to provide that nurturing environment that's going to make all the difference down the road.
Yeah, that's something that the book talks about a lot, and I I mean, again, this is something that we all know, but we don't consider all that much. And one of the things that people like myself admire you for in terms of your work is that your reporting has always been guided by, holding the view that issues that politics need to consider the society that there is. And social conditions, you know, really do determine a person's health in that sense, right?
Yeah, and I would say often we lose the focus in our public discussion, right? Mm-hmm. Like we talk about the economy, we talk about how we're going to grow it, we talk about jobs, and that's good. We need to do that stuff, but we can't assume that just because we do that, it's going to mean that everything ends up, you know, good for everyone, right? Like we live in a very rich province in a rich country, and yet, you know, something like 20% of kids grow up in poverty. So you know, we're doing well overall, but there are a significant number of people who don't share in that. And of course, it being a society, we all live together. So we all, you know, suffer the effects of, you know, whether it's the opioid crisis, whether it's, you know, demand on the healthcare system, you know, we end up paying for that inequality one way or another.
Yeah, I'm speaking to you from Vancouver, and I guess that's a city where you see inequality acutely. You know, you see that, you know, you just walk down the street, you can see that. You know, you can see people that are in distress and then this incredible wealth around the city. Do you think that'll change anytime soon, the sort of turning a blind eye to just how much inequity there is in our society, say?
I think people are aware. I think it's great that we're having discussions like this one. I was grateful for your interest in my last book, which took that issue on, you know, directly. And in some ways, this book follows out of that one, right? Where that one was about, you know, we have growing economic inequality in Canada and BC, where it's particularly obvious, right? Like you walk down Hastings Street and you know, you have high-end jewelry stores, and you have fancy cars going by, and you have people who are, you know, clearly suffering. You have people living on the street or dealing with mental health issues or addictions, and, you know, it's sort of in your face there. I think you know, it persists, but I do think there are a lot of us who don't like it. I do think the change of provincial government here may make a difference, too. You know, they are taking some action on stuff like they raised the disability and welfare rates pretty quickly after coming into government. They've been doing some stuff around housing. They've been putting money towards childcare. They are sort of mapping out a direction that is positive, I think. And I say that in a nonpartisan way, just observing the policies. It is the kind of stuff that I was talking about in the last book. There is a long way to go, so I don't think the change is going to be overnight. But I, you know, at least they are talking about, you know, an anti-poverty strategy and ways to make things more affordable. And we'll see what happens, how that goes. I often say, you know, these are, you know, we talk about the difference that raising children in a nurturing environment makes. You know, when we talk about making changes, we have to be looking, you know, 20, 30 years down the road. You know, I don't think any government can expect to do, you know, a few changes and see a huge difference in a year or two or within a, you know, budget cycle or the 4 years that a government's in place. I do think we need to be looking out, you know, 20, 30 years and you know, how do we build healthy generations. We're dealing now with the effects of, you know, past policies, right? Like there's a lag between when the policies are in place and the effects you see.
Right.
So when you look at the opioid crisis and, you know, sort of the dislocation a lot of people feel, you know, that's the result of what we've done in the past. And you know, so if we're thinking about what are we going to do in the future, I think we should be looking, you know, at least a couple decades out to see the difference it can make.
You know, everyone knows that governments are implacable, bureaucracies are. Do you think you're seeing that sort of foresight in government today, and I mean, the politicians can only do so much. But I mean, they're an important part in all of this. Are they, say, moved to do something? And by that I mean to rethink how health care is delivered, because that's another thing that you talk in the book, that no matter how much money one spends on the ministry year after year, whether that be in BC or in Ottawa, nothing seems to improve. And as you know, some people think that throwing more money at it is the way to go, but you know, that's certainly not. So are you seeing innovation, say, in terms of how governments think about how to deliver health care, say?
Yes. So a couple of things I would say there. First, when we talk about health in this country, we tend to think immediately of health care. Mm-hmm. So we're thinking doctors and nurses and hospitals and drugs. And already we spend a lot on that, right? Like we spend something like 11% of our gross domestic product. It's 42% of the provincial budget in BC, and in most provinces. We spend like more than $200 billion across the country on it. And one of the key points of the book is that the things that really affect your health, like the healthcare system, is less than a quarter of how healthy you're going to be as a person is related to the healthcare system. Mm. The figure that often gets quoted is that about 75% is dependent on what's referred to as the social determinants of health, right? So it's income, education, housing, all those things that happen long before you come into contact with the healthcare system. And then the other 25% is a combination of your genetics and the healthcare you get. We spend ever-increasing amounts on this healthcare system that is there sort of as a, you know, the catchment for the people who once they get sick, but we do less. At least compared to other countries you might compare with, like countries in the OECD or in Europe in particular, when it comes to, you know, support for families or for early childhood or all the things that happen outside the healthcare system that contribute to health. So in terms of the politics of it, I do think it's tough for them. I mean, that's one of the questions the book asks is, you know, it goes back to the 1970s when we had the Lalonde Report, which, basically pointed out the same direction that, you know, we need to do a lot more to support people outside the healthcare system. That will take some of the burden off the healthcare system. And yet there's not a lot of action on it. I think, you know, at times the politicians have really gotten it. I think, you know, Jane Philpott, who was the federal health minister, you know, she came to office with that background as a doctor and knowing a lot about the social determinants of health. We've talked about it for 30 years or so, but I don't have the sense that the public is quite there, right? Like there's excitement about, you know, the newest drug, the newest treatment. There's demand for, you know, I want a hospital near me. I want to see a doctor, you know, as fast as possible. But I think there's less understanding that the evidence is very strong that we could do a lot more to increase the average health of the population by supporting, you know, particularly by supporting people raising children and more broadly by dealing with poverty and dealing with inequality.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned in the book Alex Gervais, and this is a young man who the system failed. I want to ask about the ministry itself, the Ministry of Children and Families, because as we all know, the government changed a year ago. Have you seen any improvement in how that, say, that ministry has, say, treated children within the system?
I think the Children and Families Ministry in particular is a tough one. I think there's good intention there. I think some of the issues are long-term and entrenched. So I think the kinds of changes I'm talking about will take a while. I think there's interest, obviously, but I don't think anybody has a magic wand on it. In terms of direction of the government, to your last question, I meant to mention as well that they are doing stuff around primary care, where mm-hmm. they're doing more to set up urgent care centers and bring in more nurse practitioners and that sort of thing too. And I have had the sense that there is interest in the book. The health minister read it, Adrian Dix, pretty early on, and he's been reading to it. Like he did a talk for the doctors of BC where he read from it to them. The housing minister read it and is very big on talking about housing as something that contributes to health. On the Ministry of Children and Family Development side, you know, the part of what we're seeing there is the legacy of, oh, I don't know, 100 years of stuff that's gone on. You know, it's the residential schools and then the echo of that with the 60s scoop. And then the echo of that we're seeing now where you know, there's sort of this been an effort, I would say, as part of colonization to you know, break particularly Indigenous families from their culture, you know, very, you know, deliberately. Like there was the old quote about removing the child from the Indian from the child or something like that. And I think we are dealing with the impact of that. So reversing that is a long-term project. I do think the current government has good intentions, but it's a big thing to make a difference on.
The overdose crisis is something that you talk. I mean, everyone's talking about it. So it makes sense that it would be something at the center of your book. What does the book talk about in terms of how it's gotten this bad and whether it could have been prevented? And I guess, you know, now that I think about it, probably the better question is where do we go from here, especially with the myriad of social issues that are a part of, say, what's going on in terms of the opioid crisis? How does one start addressing that?
Yeah, for me, I learned a lot about the crisis through the work on the book. As a reporter, for the most part, I hadn't covered it a whole lot. You know, stories came up that tended to be depressing. You know, it was numbers from the coroner's service.
Right.
It was, you know, the health ministry declaring an emergency. It was demands for sort of more harm reduction approaches. And for the most part, for me, I found those stories, you know, sort of depressing and overwhelming. So the book sort of traces through, you know, the discussion, what was happening, and it talks a lot about harm reduction. You know, the things like the safe injection sites and you know, knowing who's likely to overdose and the steps that can be taken to make sure that, you know, people get the message that they shouldn't be using alone, that kind of thing, that people should be trained with Narcan, that can reverse the effects of opioids. But then it sort of takes a step from there to take a broader approach. It looks at the work of people like Gabor Maté or Bruce Alexander, where they talk about the roots of addiction. You know, so Gabor Maté talks a lot about trauma and the unresolved trauma that is common in our society. And Bruce Alexander as well talks about, you know, there are a couple of things with addiction. One is someone has to have some kind of predisposition to it, and then also whatever it is they're going to be addicted to has to be available. And he sort of lumps in, you know, he sort of says drugs and alcohol are sort of one of the smallest parts of it. You know, we have, you see addictive types of relationships with, you know, food or television or the internet for many people. And he looks at it as sort of a social issue where when a society is breaking down, when there's sort of widespread dislocation and people not feeling like they belong, you see a rise in addictions of all sorts. So that's sort of where that chapter ends up. And that last part, I'm not sure. I mean, it's helpful. So there are a couple things in terms of going forward, which was your question. One is that we have to do that harm reduction stuff. You know, we have to react to the crisis we have.
Yeah.
You know, and that may, you know, I think things like the drug testing that's become available is important. I think the messaging, the public awareness stuff is important. I think we really should be having a discussion about legalizing drugs and making sure that the supply is safe, right? The problem isn't people deliberately overdosing. They're taking drugs where they don't know what's in it, right? They think they're taking one thing and they're getting enough fentanyl with it to poison them.
Yeah.
So cleaning up the supply, and that probably means legalizing it, would make a difference. So, but at the same time, if you want to step back from it in some ways, as a reporter, you have the luxury of looking at it from 40,000 feet. You say, well, wouldn't it be good to prevent this in the first place, and how would we do that? When I look at Gabor Mate's work and I look at Bruce Alexander's work, my conclusion is, we need to build a society where people feel like they belong, like they have meaning in their lives, where there's, less addiction, there's less need for, people feel less need for these things.
And obviously
that's much easier to say than it is to do.
Yeah, and do you think the public is there yet? I mean, you talked a moment ago about where the public is, and there's a lot of people still who think that, it's a criminal issue, and it's something that needs to be dealt with. Say, you use the law in that sense. Where are we there in terms of us and the public?
I think there's a discussion. I think in BC in general, we're at one end of it. I think all the main political parties, for instance, would take the broader perspective on it. Remember, like with Insight, there was the fight with Ottawa where the BC Liberals who on our spectrum in BC were sort of the right-wing party, were all for it when the federal government under Stephen Harper were trying to shut it down. I think there's more of a realism in BC on it than there is elsewhere. I think we're moving that way too. You look at the discussion around the legalization of marijuana, where we'll actually be there this fall,
right.
A couple months late, but we're going there. I'm 45 years old, almost 46, and through most of my life, marijuana has been treated as a criminal issue.
Mm.
So we've shifted on that one, and I think with time we'll shift on the other drugs as well. It's definitely a discussion. It's definitely a debate, and I'm not sure where the majority is right now, but I would certainly say the perspective on it seems to be overall becoming broader, to me anyway.
Yeah, and then that's the one thing that I found particularly enjoyable is not the right word, but I liked about the book is that you don't have a pessimistic view about where we're headed, even though it may seem dire for a lot of people. You generally have a positive outlook in terms of where we're headed, right?
I think we are able, right? I guess the way I would put it is I'm deliberately optimistic.
Mm.
It would be easy to spend a lot of time at Hastings in Maine and get really depressed and say, well, nothing's ever going to change. And I think if you do that, well, then nothing does change. Right. So the attitude I take, and like I say, it's deliberate. It may be in the face of all evidence that I shouldn't. Is that we can be our best selves, and we can find a way forward that makes sense, that values people, that says yes, our goal should be maximizing the health of the maximum number of people. And that there would be interest in doing that. If I was sort of clear eyed on the evidence of it, there's lots of evidence that we aren't going to go that way. But then there's also lots of indication that there are people who are interested in having that conversation, certainly at the political level and in the public as well. So
yeah.
So I don't know. I will remain optimistic.
And then that's your book is a marvelous way for us to start talking about these things. It's a great book, an important one, as I said. Congratulations on it, Andrew. It's good talking again.
Yeah, thank you. Good to talk with you as well. And it helps to have people like you helping get the word out there about these things. You know, the book doesn't do much good if nobody reads it. So thank you for your efforts to let people know.
The book is called Altogether Healthy, A Canadian Wellness Revolution. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. It's author Andrew McLeod. Join me on the line from Victoria. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.